Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it. Hey, before we get started this week, Jordy, I just want to say I really appreciate all the hard work you put in putting these episodes together. You know, I done the last two episodes, and that was a lot of work. A lot of research goes into it, and then once you have all that research done, then you have to write a script. So I just wanted to say I really appreciate it, and I hope everybody out there really appreciates all the hard work you put into this podcast.
Oh, well, thank you so much for saying that, actually. That's a little bit of a surprise. But yeah, it is a lot of work, and I don't think a lot of people understand how much work it is. I mean, yeah, of course, it's like you just hit record and speak into a microphone. How hard is that? But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of pre-planning to it, like researching a case, putting the script together, recording it, editing it, putting it out there. So, and especially for an independent podcast, because, you know, we both have full-time jobs. So this is honestly a whole nother job on its own, but we love doing it, and I appreciate you throwing yourself into it too and taking the time to research cases and record episodes for us, because I know a lot of people out there appreciate it. They love hearing you when you talk and when you do episodes, so maybe we can get him to record some more episodes in the future, the very near future, so because I think it was like a 30-week gap, so
I plan on doing more, you know, and also I'm going to throw in, like, just because you read something on the internet, like, doesn't mean it's exactly true. So a lot of the work is going back and fact checking, because you'll hear something and you'll hear completely different somewhere else.
That is another big thing. Honestly, probably most of the time is you'll find like three or four good sources, and then every single one of them has something different happening in it. And it's not usually like they have like the main points of the case or whatever we're talking about, like, correct. But then it'll be like little things like, oh, they did this and this. It's like, well, wait a minute, that article said they did this. So it's literally like Oprah Winfrey. What is the truth? So a lot of the time it's just finding more than one article that matches the information. And so it's like, okay, this is definitely what happened. It kind of just got lost in the shuffle. So yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but it is very rewarding. We love doing it, love bringing it to you guys, because not only are we bringing awareness to cases and things, you know, we don't want people to be forgotten or anything like that. So it's really important that we bring awareness to people, and I'm glad that we can offer that. And at the same time, we kind of transformed into a queer history podcast for a lot of the time. You know, a lot of the episodes have little queer history bits here and there. And honestly, that's taught me a lot, especially like, since we've started this podcast, I've learned so much about little-known queer history that I've never heard before or never knew about. And so it's really just interesting for me, too, to be able to bring you guys this information if you've never heard it before. And so, yeah, I really appreciate you guys hanging in there with us while we learn and grow as an independent podcast. And thank you, Brad, for all your hard work and doing this each week. And yeah.
And not to delay the podcast any farther, but also it being a more queer-focused podcast makes it kind of unique in that I haven't seen a lot of them out there, at least not mainstream. And then it's kind of refreshing for a podcast where you're like, it's not the husband every time. You know, I mean, 9 times out of 10 in most straight podcasts, it's the husband. So
That too. It's really interesting. I like, you know, that we get to focus on this sort of niche side of the true crime side, especially with such an underrepresented minority like queer people, especially queer people of color. And so I think that's another really important thing that we can help bring awareness to. You know, we're not like some massive podcast yet. That's our 2024 goal by the end of it, to be a mainstream podcast. But we're on our way up. And so just the fact that we can bring it to the listeners we have now is so important because, you know, as long as you have one person that's moved by or gets them thinking differently, then we have done something right.
And of course, you can help out with that by just sharing or telling people about the podcast. And we really appreciate that.
You totally can. Tell all your queer friends, all your ally to queer friends, you know, everyone you know. It helps grow the podcast. And we love new listeners and we love hearing from you guys. So with that, yeah, that was not planned. So I really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, I threw a monkey wrench in this episode already, folks.
So yes, thank you guys so much for continuing to listen. So with that, let's get into today's case because today's case is going to be a rough one and it is going to be a very serious topic. So we are going to deal with this as delicately as we can. So it's the night of Saturday, July 18th, 2009 in the area of South Park located on the southern edge of Seattle, Washington. On the quiet suburban lane of South Rose Street, things were calm and winding down after an unusually hot day. It's around 3 a.m., and by this point, not many residents on the street are awake save for a few people, including a woman named Jennifer Dawson Lutz, who was getting ready to lay down after feeding her newborn infant. So it should be noted that a lot of people in this area, especially when it gets hot like this, they don't turn the AC on because that gets expensive. So a lot of the times it's just easier to crack a window or two and just let the air flow naturally. So that's what Jennifer was doing. She was going around the house, opening windows just a little bit to let the air in. And as she went into the bathroom to open the bathroom window, the peace and quiet of the summer night was suddenly shattered by a horrific scream that echoed all throughout the neighborhood. Jennifer looked outside to spot the small red house just a few doors up from her own. She watched as a person seemed to fall out of one of the house's windows, and believing someone was trying to break in, she quickly called the police. Now, meanwhile, just a few doors down the road from Jennifer, a birthday party was just winding down for an 18-year-old named Israel Rodriguez. But as everyone was preparing to call it a night, that's when they spotted something strange. A woman, completely nude and covered in blood, was limping down the street screaming for help. Israel and several other party guests ran to help as others called 911, and by this point the entire neighborhood had awoken and stepped out onto their porches to see what was going on. By this point the bloody and nude woman was running from house to house, pounding on the doors and begging for someone to help her. As Israel and several neighbors approached her, they could see that she was actually holding onto her neck very tightly, covering a deep gash in her throat. Now, after wrapping a shirt around the woman's neck, that's when everyone noticed that the woman wasn't alone. A second woman, also completely nude and covered in blood, was lying on the pavement in the middle of the road, and it appeared she was attempting to crawl away but collapsed and was now motionless. So it's at this point that everyone actually realized who the women are and where they came from. The women lived in a red house located towards the end of the street, and they were named Teresa Butts and her fiancé, Jennifer Hopper. Now, both were known to be very friendly with everyone and always said hi to the neighbors, even if they didn't know them that well. And it's also at this point that everyone realizes that both women have been violently attacked and suffered multiple stab wounds over their entire bodies. Now, the one who was running down the street screaming for help turned out to be Jennifer, while Teresa laid in the street unconscious. Neighbors tried desperately to get the bleeding to stop for both women by wrapping towels and shirts tightly around their wounds until an ambulance finally arrived. Now, two ambulances arrived and both women were separated to be treated for their wounds on the way to the hospital. In the back of the ambulance, Jennifer, despite her own life-threatening injuries, just kept asking about Teresa and if she was okay, before finally pulling the paramedic in close and telling him, "He told us if we did what he asked us to do, he wouldn't hurt us. He lied," before falling unconscious. Now, as both women are being rushed to the hospital, let's go back and tell you guys a little bit about Jennifer and Teresa and their relationship. So, Teresa Ann Butts was born on October 19, 1969, to Dolly and Norbert Butts in St. Louis and was the seventh of 11 children born to the couple, actually being the first girl they had. Now, the family was deeply religious and attended the St. Stephen Catholic Church regularly. Teresa was described as being naturally athletic her entire life, from an early age being good at playing both baseball and soccer. Now, the family was also described as being a musical family, with the entire clan all playing different instruments and often putting on shows for their church. Now, Teresa was known as the dancer of the Butts clan and became obsessed with the works of Michael Jackson after buying his album Thriller. Of course, I think we've all been there. Now, from an early age, Teresa was described as being very much a tomboy and often preferred playing with toys meant for boys and wearing pants over dresses. She was extremely fit and muscular, and both at school and at home, she actually acted as a protector for her older brothers. She was not afraid to speak her mind or fight a boy if they were picking on her brothers. And more often than not, she would always win because when I say she was fit, she was very fit and she knew how to fight. And at home, if she felt like her father would punish one of the boys for something that she didn't think was right, she was not afraid to speak up and voice her disagreement for it. So that's another big thing. A lot of people are afraid of their fathers, especially like disciplining them. So the fact that she was brave enough to be like, hey, Dad, I don't think what you're doing is right. I don't think they deserve that harsh of a punishment. Shows you just how fearless she was from an early age.
Plus, she's standing up for her brothers. It's not even like she's standing up for herself, mm-hmm. which I'm sure she did, but she's standing up for somebody else. So she's like a protector.
Yeah, so she was a natural protector her whole life for everyone that, like, if she didn't agree with her, didn't think it was right, she did not care to speak her mind. Now, Teresa was also never afraid to go against the norms expected of a, you know, good Catholic girl. At one point, performing a talent show dance routine dressed as a man, and her parents, nor her friends or classmates ever really pushed back or made fun of her for it, with several of her school friends later saying, honestly, the thought that she might be a lesbian never even crossed our minds. It was such a foreign concept to us. And that goes to show you, too, is like a lot of times, especially in these small religious communities, the thought of someone being homosexual or queer didn't even register. So the fact that, you know, she's just a tomboy, she just likes boyish things, but never once, it was so foreign of a concept where they're like, maybe she likes girls. Now, Teresa never had a boyfriend all throughout school and into her teenage years, and she began to act out and run away from home for periods of time. And I think she was going through that stage a lot of queer people go through when they reach that certain age where they're kind of fighting emotions because, you know, you're taught, you know, homosexual is bad. And so when you're a teenager, you're like, well, why am I feeling this way? I shouldn't feel this way. And so it's all those conflicting feelings just attacking you at once on top of normal teenage puberty angst. So
especially in a Catholic home.
Oh, yeah, big time, especially in a very religious home. So Teresa graduated from high school and started attending Truman State University in 1988, but sadly started to have trouble almost right away. So she attempted to actually throw herself into college culture by trying to join a sorority, but was rejected by everyone for her quote-unquote masculine energy. She tried to still attend college and frat parties, but during one incident was actually pelted with beer and cups by everyone at the party until she left, and soon after she transferred out of college, because remember, people can be absolute shitbags.
That's absolutely horrible. Like that's stuff that happens in movies, not in real life.
Yeah, it sounds like those are stereotypical movie bullies, and they were. They were freaking shitheads. So soon after that, she transferred to Mizzou University for a semester, and I'm sorry if I butchered that. But shortly after arriving, she actually confided in her friends that she had been sexually assaulted following a date with a boy and soon after transferred schools again. She finally transferred to the University of Missouri, and she graduated with a degree in business. Now, Teresa worked for a time out of college, but seemed dissatisfied with her life, and eventually she uprooted her entire life and answered an ad to work on cruise lines out of Alaska. So she essentially cut off all contact with her family and friends, and she remained alone for several years. So again, she was in that position I think a lot of people can relate to, especially queer people, is that, you know, you're kind of lost after high school. You're on your own. You don't really know what you want to do because it's like you pick something and that's what you do for the rest of your life. And you know, that's kind of what you're taught and told. And especially she had such a hard time with people making fun of her and ganging up on her and being assaulted. And so she was just kind of lost in life and just trying to figure something to do. So I totally get where she's coming from. Now, while working on the cruise ships, Teresa would meet a woman named Caroline, and the two would eventually begin dating. Teresa actually confided in her older brother, Norbert Jr., that she was gay, and he fully accepted her. So Norbert Jr. was actually a theater actor and even acted in the play The Normal Heart as a victim of the AIDS crisis, and he had many queer friends, so it was never an issue for him. And actually, fun fact, Norbert Jr. is actually a two-time Tony Award winner on Broadway under the name Norbert Leo Butts, and he's actually been in a lot of major TV shows and movies that you've probably seen him in. And he is still acting today in theater and movies. So at that point, Norbert Jr. really became his sister's closest confidant, and he helped her write a letter to her mother and father, and although both weren't too thrilled at first, they made it known that they still loved and accepted her. So honestly, best case scenario, like they may have been like, you know, we're not really thrilled on the idea, but at the same time, we still love you. We're not going to treat you any differently. And her father actually revealed that while he was in the Navy, he once reported a man for making quote-unquote indecent advances, and he had to watch as the man was nearly beaten to death before being dishonorably discharged. And he said that he still carried a lot of guilt over the incident, and he regretted reporting the man, saying, quote-unquote, he thought he was just following orders. Both her parents would later say that they were more concerned that Teresa's life would be hard and that she would be discriminated against, more so than the fact that she was gay. And I think a lot of parents have that fear, in that it's not so much the fact that you like, you know, the same sex. It's more so the fact that we're terrified that your life is going to be very hard. People are going to target you and discriminate against you. And that's what worries a lot of parents. But, you know, it's still better than trying to pretend to be something you're not.
And having a family that's backing you and, like, having a solid foundation that you can feel supported in goes a long way in helping all of that problem with the outside world.
And that too is like, just be supportive of your kid. Yeah, they may face difficulties and hardships, but you can be like their biggest ally. And as long as they have people in their corner that love and support them, you can work through anything. And so it's always, you know what they say, don't be your kid's first bully. Just love and accept them. Now, although she is now out and proud to her family, Teresa still struggled greatly to find her place in the world. And by 2005, she was still trying to discover what she wanted to do career-wise, and every relationship she had failed and she was alone, which pushed her into a deep depression. Now, this comes to a head when on St. Patrick's Day, Teresa is arrested for drunk driving, and this incident shakes her enough that she decides it's finally time to get her life together, and she decided to uproot her life again and move to Seattle and get a job working at a firm that manages office buildings. Now, the job pays well and allows Teresa to purchase the red house located on South Rose Street in South Park in 2006, something she was extremely proud of, which, you know, she's finally on her own. She's got her own house. She's doing good. Things are on the up and up. And things finally seem to be coming into place for Teresa. All that was missing was someone to spend it with. But fate seemed to show its cards when one day at the office, Teresa received a call from a woman looking for a job. And that woman's name was Jennifer Hopper. Now, Jennifer Hopper was born in 1972 to parents Sam and Marcia in a small remote cabin in the mountains of Santa Fe. Now, neither of her parents' last name was actually Hopper, and in fact was completely made up by them because they were in fact hiding and on the run. Sam had been drafted for Vietnam and he shipped off to Korea, but after serving for several months, he began to grow disenchanted with the war and just military life in general. So upon his return to San Francisco, he was tasked with drafting other men into the war, and instead he chose to go AWOL and flee with his pregnant wife into hiding. So that just goes to show you that the war was bad enough that he chose to risk it all just to never have to go back. So in order to support themselves, Sam did odd jobs around town in order to support his family, and they lived actually pretty comfortably. However, Sam's drinking began to grow worse and worse, and by the time Jennifer was 5, Marcia had had enough and fled back home to her parents' house in Seattle with Jennifer. Now, the two struggled for several years as Marcia ruptured several discs in her back and was unable to work, forcing them to rely on food stamps and support from Jennifer's grandparents. Sadly, Marcia eventually became addicted to painkillers, and Marcia moved in with her grandparents and began to split her time between their house and her grandparents' house on her father's side, which is always difficult. I have family that suffers from drug abuse and stuff like that, and so it's a very difficult thing, especially when you're that young. For years, Marcia struggled with addiction, and Jennifer felt helpless to do anything to help her. She turned to music and singing as an outlet for her troubles, and it proved to be a very natural gift to her. She was a very gifted singer. Jennifer joined the school choir and began acting in musicals, and her mother seemed to start doing better until one day Jennifer came home and found that her mother had actually tried to commit suicide by overdosing on pills. And it was Jennifer who had to call 911 to come save her. So Jennifer eventually moved in with her grandmother full-time after her grandfather passed away in 1988, and the two grew close, and Jennifer began to thrive in school. Although still dealing with the pain of her mother's addiction issues, she never let it dampen her spirits with teachers and friends alike, stating she was always so positive and happy on the outside, and she never made any indication that there was any sort of trouble at home. Jennifer eventually graduated from high school and for a time went to school for theater in New York, but found herself missing her grandmother and old friends, and she eventually moved back to Seattle for a time before a friend convinced her to go back and finish her training in the theater. Now, upon returning to the theater in 1993, Jennifer began to thrive once again and began making plenty of new friends, including several lesbians, which piqued her interest as she had dated several men throughout her life but never really felt a connection with any of them. So Jennifer spends the next few years at school before graduating and returning to Seattle again to live with her grandmother and worked at a print shop. It's here Jennifer begins her first relationship with a female coworker and even comes out to her grandmother, which, unlike Teresa, this one didn't go too well. And her grandmother didn't really want to talk about it or accept the fact that Jennifer was a lesbian, and they kind of just, one of those things where she's like, I don't want to hear it, don't talk about it around me. So Jennifer began to feel her life slip away around this point, because not only with her grandmother not accepting her, but also because of the stress, she actually began to develop essentially calluses on her vocal cords and had to undergo surgery to fix them, which prevented her from singing for several months, putting her into a deep depression. Now, she would eventually recover her voice and move back to New York City, where she meets and begins a relationship with a woman named Anne for almost 6 years before the two finally go their separate ways, and Jennifer once again returns to Seattle in 2006 and begins looking for a job, calling around and inquiring about places that are hiring, one of which is the building where Teresa works. So Teresa works with new hires, and thus when Jennifer is hired at her firm, she is the one who walks her through everything she needs to do and how to get started, and the two just kind of naturally begin making small talk, finding out that they have several interests in common, including music taste and the fact that they both like women. So on a date that both women say they'll remember forever, July 31st, 2007, they decided to attend a concert together and go out for drinks afterwards. As the two sat and talked and the conversation got deeper and deeper, Teresa eventually admitted to Jennifer, I just really want to kiss you. And Jennifer replied, I've been wanting you to all night. And from that night on, the two remained inseparable from one another, with Jennifer later saying, I finally felt at home. So Teresa takes Jennifer back to her home in South Park, and eventually the two develop a routine, with Jennifer staying with her grandmother during the week and spending the weekends at Teresa's, letting excitement build up throughout the week until they see each other on the weekends, which I think, you know, if you've been in that kind of relationship, it's like the giddiness, like that feeling in your stomach that builds up, and it's like, just two more days and I get to go see them and spend the weekend with them. And so it was really cute. Both of them finally felt at home with each other and accepted and loved, and it just, everything seemed to fall in place with them. Now, eventually the two move in together and began weaving the fabrics of their lives together, attending church regularly, getting to know Teresa's neighbors, and going to Pride. It's at Pride, a year after their first kiss, that Teresa and Jennifer finally agreed that it was time that they settled down and fully commit to each other. So now, while same-sex marriage was still illegal at the time, they decided to have a commitment ceremony and set a date for September 12, 2009. Both women are excited to tell their families about the ceremony, with Jennifer's grandmother still refusing to acknowledge Jennifer as a lesbian. And Teresa's parents have a similar reaction, with her father, Norbert Sr., at first refusing to go, but eventually getting a change of heart and agreeing to come along with Dolly and Norbert Jr., who flew out to Seattle to spend time with his sister in the months leading up to her wedding. So when Norbert Jr. flew out to Seattle, him and Teresa spent every single day together for several weeks, and on Sunday, July 19th, 2009, Norbert Jr. was supposed to meet his sister in order to hang out once again and discuss the wedding plans, and it's then he learns the horrific news of what transpired the previous night. And with that, that leads us back to where we began on July 18th, 2009. Teresa and Jennifer spent the day going on a tour of local breweries in the area while discussing wedding plans. Teresa was excited because the two had actually enough finances to do the wedding specifically how they wanted to. And following the brewery tour, the two stopped by a local dressmaker's in order for Jennifer to be fitted for her wedding dress before heading to the store and getting supplies to make steaks and their favorite meal. Now that evening, Teresa's mom, Dolly, called the home to tell the two that she would be coming to their wedding and that she loved them both, which instantly made Teresa even more happy, because that's another thing too, especially if you have parents that are kind on the fence, like they're not comfortable with you being queer, but they accept you still. But to hear them like actually say, like, we're coming to this very important day for you, and not only do we love you, we love your partner. And I can't even imagine how over the moon she felt, like this, everything's falling into place, it's perfect. So following dinner, the two sat and watched a movie while cuddled up on the couch before deciding to call it a night around midnight. Jennifer went around and checked to make sure all the doors were locked before getting into bed, telling Teresa she loved her and going to sleep. Now the two weren't sure how long they were actually asleep before Jennifer woke up to see the outline of a tall man in the dark standing at the foot of their bed. As her eyes adjusted to the figure, Jennifer realized that it was a man, fully nude, standing over her with a butcher knife in his hand. Before she had time to react, the man lunged forward and held the knife up to her throat and told her to be quiet.
That is terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. Just to wake up, like I wake up sometimes from, I have horrible night terrors a lot of the time, and just to like, I think I see a figure standing at the foot of the bed, but just imagining waking up out of a deep sleep and you're like, is that, are my eyes playing tricks on me? Is that just a shadow? And then fully realizing, no, that is a like 6 foot tall man standing over me at the foot of the bed. So I can't even imagine what's going through her head, because you're like waking up, like even for a brief moment, you're going to be like, is this a nightmare, or like a really realistic nightmare, or is this actually happening? But by this point, Teresa had also woken up, and the man told her to be quiet as well. He told both women that he didn't want to hurt them and that he only wanted to have sex with them, and if they would, he would leave them alone. Now, a very extreme trigger warning for the next little bit of this episode, because it does involve sexual assault, and so we are going to be talking about sexual assault. So very big trigger warning for this part, probably skip ahead about 10 minutes. Now the man ordered both women to remove their clothes and lay still on the bed. He climbed on top of Teresa and proceeded to sexually assault her, holding the knife to her throat while he did it. After he was done, he ordered Teresa to perform oral sex on Jennifer while he watched. Teresa pretended to do it, but instead found Jennifer's hand and held it tightly. Jennifer tried to remain as still as possible, hoping he would just leave soon, while still holding on to Teresa's hand while he sexually assaulted her. Now the man forced Jennifer to get off the bed and bend over and proceeded to sexually assault her anally. And by this point, Teresa was praying out loud and reciting the Lord's Prayer. Jennifer joined her and began to pray to God to let them live. Now after he was done with Jennifer, he grabbed Teresa off the bed and forced her to the ground and ordered her to perform oral sex on him. Again, after he was done, Teresa climbed back on the bed and huddled against the wall with Jennifer as the man told them, I promise I'm not going to hurt you, but don't get too excited, because that was just round one.
That's awful to be a witness to, not only like someone you love being sexually assaulted, but you're also going to be sexually assaulted as well. It's absolutely one of the worst things I can think of.
Yeah, it's just horrible. I absolutely, my heart breaks even having to read it. Like, I feel disgusting, but it is an important part of this story and this case later on. But yeah, just the fact that the person you love the most is right beside you and you can't really do anything, or you risk not only yourself getting hurt or getting killed, but their life as well. And so it's just, I can't even imagine. Now, over the next 3 hours, the man routinely sexually assaulted the women multiple times, vaginally, orally, and anally, with small breaks in between. By the end of what the man referred to as round 3 of sexual assaults, he finally actually started to talk with the women and he actually asked them if they were lesbians or just bisexuals. Now, the two responded that they were lesbians and that they were actually set to be married in about a month. And so they were kind of hoping, like, maybe he'll just leave now if he knows, like, yes, we're lesbians and we are planning on getting married and starting a life together. So it's kind of that, like, humanizing yourself to the captor to let them know that you are a human being. Now, Jennifer also took the opportunity to see if she could get any answers as to why this was happening. She asked the man if he had seen them before, and he actually replied no, he didn't know who was in the house when he came in. And they even, Teresa kind of quick back at him, like, well, what would you do if it was a man here? And the dude kind of just brushed it off and said, probably nothing different.
That's very scary.
Terrifying.
A random break-in with the intent of raping whoever is inside that building. That is absolutely terrifying.
And it just adds to that one where it's like, it's completely random. Like, there's no rationale behind it. There's no vendetta. There wasn't no stalking or anything like that. It was literally just, that is the house he chose. Now, after this, he actually went on to say, you guys seem like good people. I wish we could have been friends. Teresa, attempting to defuse the situation, told the man that maybe they still actually could be friends if he let them go. The man asked her, do I seem like a good person to you? And in a move, Jennifer says she will never forget, Teresa crawled over to the man and placed her hand over his heart and stated, I'm sure there is good in there. The man responded, no more questions, before climbing back on top of Jennifer to assault her. Now, after he was done, the man climbed off of her and then stood at the foot of the bed, staring at both women, and it was at that moment Jennifer would later say, I knew he lied, he was going to hurt us, he was going to kill us. The man calmly walked out of the room and disappeared into the guest bedroom for a brief moment before returning with another knife in his hand. In an instant, he pounced on the bed and began to slash away Teresa's neck with both knives before turning his attention to Jennifer and doing the same thing. Both women suffered deep gashes to their throats before the man started stabbing them both in the chest. Now, both women fought desperately to fight him off, but found that the more they fought, the more blood poured from their wounds. And it was at that moment Jennifer thought, this is how I'm going to die. I wonder if what Teresa told me about heaven is true. Jennifer felt a moment of peace before relaxing her body and giving in, fully accepting the fact that this was where she was going to die. Now, as Jennifer relaxed and was ready to accept her fate, she looked over at Teresa and realized that Teresa was not going down without a fight, and she was fighting like hell. The man was focusing all his attention on Teresa at this point since she was still fighting so hard, and eventually she used what might she had left to kick the man directly in the face and send him flying off the bed. Now, seizing the opportunity, Teresa leapt from the bed and grabbed the metal nightstand that sat beside it. The man had dropped the knives at this point and instead tried to fight Teresa, punching her in the face and breaking four of her teeth. Teresa did not let that stop her as she reared back and slammed the nightstand into the man's head, knocking him to the ground. With him down, Teresa turned her attention to the window and threw the nightstand, shattering it before jumping out of it herself and running down the street screaming for help. Now, you want to talk about a bad bitch move. She fought, and she did not. She was like, I am not going to lay here and let you kill me. And she actually got a few good licks in, too. Now, it's at that moment Jennifer stood up and looked out the window to see Teresa collapse on the pavement. The man was also now standing again, and the two actually made eye contact and just kind of stared at each other for a minute, and both were kind of unsure of what to do or what's going to happen next, before the man took off out of the house and into the night. So just almost as quickly as he arrived, he's gone. Jennifer ran through the front door and began screaming for someone to help as neighbors rushed out of their homes and towards her and Teresa. Now we are kind of back to where we started. As they were being loaded into the ambulances, Jennifer screamed and screamed at Teresa, telling her, I love you, know that I love you, you have to fight, you need to fight. Jennifer was rushed into emergency surgery, the entire time leading up to it asking about Teresa and her condition, and informing the cops of what happened and about the man, whom she described as being black and muscular with little hair and a very soft-spoken voice. Doctors and investigators kept assuring Jennifer that they would let her know when they received any updates on Teresa's condition. However, sadly, they already knew her fate from the moment they were loaded into the ambulances. Teresa had passed away from blood loss from her wounds not long after being loaded into the ambulance. Jennifer would thankfully make a full recovery and within a few days was actually released from the hospital to her new life without Teresa into a community that was now on high alert and terrified of an unknown killer and rapist on the loose.
Teresa saved Jennifer's life.
Oh, yeah. And again, that goes back to when she was a little kid. She was a protector. She stood up for people, those she loved especially. And so that was part of it, too, is Teresa was like, I'm not just fighting for myself. I'm fighting for Jennifer's life, too. So I'm going to do whatever I can to save us. And if not myself, to save Jennifer. And later on, I'll mention it, but Jennifer was like, she saved me that night. Because if she didn't do what she did, then he would have just kept stabbing us until we were both dead. And so that was her, she used her final bit of strength to save the one she loved. So now, fortunately for everyone, it would not take long to track down who this unknown man was, as it was already someone who was very familiar to police. So Teresa and Jennifer's home was swept for DNA and fingerprints, and Jennifer agreed to a rape kit, which they were able to use to retrieve semen of the man. 4 days after the attack, and the day before Teresa was set to be laid to rest, the DNA got a match to DNA found at the scene of a robbery the year prior, which had video surveillance footage of the robber. So the day Teresa was buried, the footage was released to the public, and within 48 hours, investigators received a call from a woman who stated, "That's my son, please don't shoot him." The man was identified as 23-year-old Isaiah Calabu, a mentally ill and convicted felon who was now homeless. So police didn't have to wait long to pick up Isaiah, as later that night, he actually boarded a Greyhound bus and began to berate the bus driver while threatening the other passengers with several calling 911. Upon arriving at the scene, officers found Isaiah rambling to himself while dressed in a thick winter coat and long jeans, despite the temperature being in the mid-90s. Officers also noticed several blood stains on his underpants and decided to bring him in for formal questioning. So while this is happening, Teresa Butts was laid to rest on July 24th, 2009, and her funeral was attended by so many people that the line to view her casket was a three-hour wait. So again, that just shows you how loved she was by everyone. People just wanted to pay their final respects to a hero. She was a hero. All the Butts family was in attendance, and although she was not mentioned in any of the eulogies or prayers, Jennifer was mentioned as the person Teresa was planning to marry, and she did sit with the Butts family, who comforted her during the funeral. So Jennifer would later say that she wasn't angry, not being included in the eulogies, as she understood that most of Teresa's family had certain things they found difficult to do or say, but at the same time she understood that they did love her and Teresa, and they respected their marriage. So it was just days after the funeral that Norbert Jr. would actually win a Tony Award on Broadway, and he dedicated it to Teresa, stating, "This is for my sister Teresa. We think about you every day." It was after the funeral, when Jennifer and the family went to Teresa's favorite bar, that Jennifer received a call from the lead detective on the case, and she simply stated, "We got him." So Isaiah would plead not guilty to first-degree murder and sexual assault 2 weeks after his arrest, and he was held on a $10 million bond while awaiting trial. So now let's tell you a little bit about Isaiah Calabu, because once you learn his history, you'll be infuriated how someone could have gone unchecked and unmedicated for so long, despite his long and serious rapport with police. So Isaiah Calabu was born on August 1st, 1985, to an unnamed mother and father. His father had actually fled to Seattle in 1980 in order to escape a civil war in his home country of Uganda. And by all accounts, Isaiah was a very normal behaving baby and had perfect health. From an early age, though, Isaiah's family was plagued with tragedy and sadness, with his mother having to identify her own mother after she threw herself into a river following a long fight with unmedicated schizophrenia. Isaiah's family had a long history of mental illness on his mother's side, and when he was 2, his mother's mental health started to deteriorate too, and he was taken in by his aunt soon after she attempted suicide. Now, he would eventually return to his mother, and not long after that, his father came to live with them and began to abuse both her and Isaiah, with police being called at least once a week for domestic disputes. But yet, nothing was ever done. He was never taken in or taken away from them. They kind of just went there, shook their finger like, "Don't do it again," and then just came back the next week. Now, Isaiah would often be bullied at school for his quiet demeanor and his scrawny appearance, so that just adds on to it. Not only does he have a shitty home life, but kids are shitheads in general, remember that. So at school was not too better. But now, despite all of these struggles, he was actually described as being very smart and polite and kind. As he became a teenager, however, his teachers began expressing concern as his behavior started getting more erratic and angry, and he had trouble focusing in class. But now, around this time, his mother was taken to the ER 5 times in the span of 2 months for multiple stab wounds, each time telling the doctors that she did them to herself, but in reality, it was Isaiah's father. It was also around this time that Isaiah's mother confided in her son, who was just 13 at the time, that she was actually the child of a rape, and she would later state that this revelation deeply disturbed Isaiah, ironically, upon hearing it. And in the following years throughout high school, Isaiah would attend 6 different schools and was homeschooled for brief periods in between each school year over various troubles, often involving him fighting with other students or growing violent out of nowhere and attacking his classmates. On one occasion, bringing a knife to school and threatening a teacher with it. Now, at first, his mother tried desperately to get help for her son, but was still under the abusive thumb of her husband, who frequently tortured her by stepping on her back and stabbing her in the legs.
That's awful.
Yeah, so this, obviously, by this point, he's just an innocent kid, but horrible. Like, his mother had a back injury from a car crash, and she couldn't bend her back all the way. She was kind of had a slouched over, and the dad would torture her by literally putting her on the floor, putting his foot in her back, and then bending it as far as he could, knowing it caused her excruciating pain. And so while at the same time, Isaiah is obviously going through mental issues and struggles, which it is hereditary, and it's kind of like she wants to get help for her son, but at the same time, she's being tortured herself.
Plus, she needs help for herself.
Yeah, like, you know, no one's helping her either. And so it's just a horrible, horrible situation. Now, by the time he was 16, the state had intervened on his home life on 6 different occasions, and each time determined that he was living in a quote-unquote adequate environment. So again, that's another thing. Literally, his mother is being taken to the ER on a regular basis for stab wounds, and
Even if she was doing it to herself, that's not a environment for a kid to be in.
No. And so it's just the fact that they're like, it seems all right to us. It's like, did you really check that hard? Because I highly doubt you did, even though that's what you're paid to do. Now, in 2003, Isaiah was attempting to go to college, but found it difficult to focus as his home life was still on the rocks. The last fight his parents had resulted in his father headbutting his mother and his mother attempting to slash his father's throat. Both finally filed for divorce and got restraining orders against the other one, and Isaiah was finally taken to a psychiatrist. But of course, by that point, the damage was already done. Isaiah couldn't handle college anymore and dropped out after 2 semesters. Not long after dropping out, Isaiah began having his first run-ins with the law, getting arrested for small things like shoplifting. He decided that he wanted to try and actually go to pilot school, you know, to become a pilot, and that seemed really good for him, but discovered in his 20s, that he was in fact colorblind, something no one in his family had ever realized before that point. And sadly, this actually prevented him from getting into pilot school, and it sent him spiraling into a deep depression. Following this, Isaiah's mental health began to decline rapidly, often breaking down in random bouts of sadness, depression, and anger, which prevented him from holding down a steady job for more than a couple of weeks. He was arrested for possession of marijuana, but got bailed out by his aunt, Rachel Calbu, who often was the one in his family to show concern for his well-being. Like, she was the only one to be like, he needs help, we need to help him, while everyone else is kind of just like, eh. So he began to actually confide in her that he was feeling extreme anxiety and pressure over not being able to go to college, or attend flight school, or hold down a job, or start a family, and it was finally starting to wear on him. He began experiencing delusions and periods of blacking out, during which he described himself as being God. He would have violent outbursts out of nowhere. He began to wander the streets, mumbling to himself with a blank look on his face and threatening anyone who got close to him. He began to break into local businesses and houses, which is where that DNA got on file from the and caught on surveillance the year before the murder. His family finally seemed to understand that something was very wrong with him, and so they actually had him committed on March 28, 2008, to Harborview Psychiatric Hospital. But now, despite behaving erratically, which included threatening several staff members and fellow patients and claiming to be an African king who could set people on fire with his mind, the doctors there determined that there wasn't enough evidence to show that Isaiah was a danger to society. So less than 10 hours after arriving, he was released without any sort of formal evaluation or medication.
Less than 10 hours. He didn't even stay there a day.
No. And after all that stuff he did, and it's like, something is obviously wrong. You're a psychiatric hospital. After being released from the hospital, Isaiah's behavior only continued to grow worse. He began to threaten everyone in his family that they should all, quote-unquote, enjoy their last days on Earth, and even smash the windshield to his mom's car. After she and several of his family members tried to get him to calm down, he took the metal leash off of his dog and swung it at their heads, hitting his mother across the face and knocking her to the ground. Now, with this, police were finally called, and Isaiah was arrested for felony harassment and mischief. Again, Isaiah's family attempted to call Harborview and get them to take Isaiah in, but they refused. Isaiah was arraigned in court, and it was determined that he was not competent to stand trial, and he was ordered to be held at Weston State Psychiatric Hospital for an evaluation. So thankfully, they're like, now the courts are like, mandatory. He has to do it. He was forced to take an antipsychotic called Zyprexa, as well as lithium, and was diagnosed with having bipolar disorder. Now, after a month, Isaiah returned to court, and the judge ordered that he make regular appointments with a mental health official for checkups and to maintain taking his medication, all of which he agreed to.
Of course,
I'm not going to say no. But little did they know that almost immediately after being released from prison, Isaiah stopped taking his medication and never attended any of his court-mandated mental health evaluations, which, again, is on him. However, none of that was reported to the courts by his family or his health care providers. So no one, like, told the courts, like, hey, he's going against this, he's not doing it, you got to make him do it. They kind of just let him do what he wanted. So in June of 2009, Isaiah's aunt Rachel called police reporting that he was off his meds and was threatening her and her family. Police found him in a parking lot waving around a golf club with his pit bull growling at anyone who came near. He was making threatening remarks to anyone he saw and attempted to charge at the officers, who promptly tased him. He was arrested and charged with disturbing the peace, and upon appearing in court, no mention was made of his prior mental health issues. And by the time he was there, Isaiah was having one of his quote-unquote normal periods where he was actually lucid and coherent. And so the judge determined that there was no reason not to release him. He seemed fine then. And that's another thing too, is like, it was periods. It was like blackout periods. Like, when he wasn't on one of his blackout periods, he was very lucid. He was very kind and polite. And it was unpredictable. So his aunt Rachel, who was also present, thanked the judge and was the one who took Isaiah home. However, not long after arriving back to his aunt's house, Isaiah's mental health started to deteriorate again, and Rachel became so fed up with it that she eventually kicked him out, and he began sleeping in the woods behind her house. So just 2 weeks before Teresa and Jennifer's attack, Isaiah's aunt Rachel would die in a mysterious house fire, along with her roommate, former NFL quarterback J.J. Jackson. Now, detectives would later determine that J.J. was actually struck across the head with a golf club before the fire was set, and they believed Isaiah was the one responsible, but he denied any involvement, and they had no physical evidence to hold him on. So, he was a free man. This is still not confirmed to this day, but it is possible that Isaiah murdered two people before he murdered Teresa and attacked Jennifer. So, following the death of his aunt and destruction of her house, Isaiah began to wander around Seattle, just kind of living in various homeless camps, and often was just found mumbling to himself on the street. He visited his father at his office on July 17, 2009, and his father would later say, "That wasn't my son. He was filled with so much rage and hatred." Probably because you tortured his mom his whole childhood.
That was what I was about to say. I was like, is this the same dad that was like beating the family and torturing the mom?
Yeah. So I'm sure he would be. I'd be filled with rage and hatred too.
Yeah, thanks, Dad.
So Isaiah would sit in prison awaiting his trial, which would begin nearly 2 years after he murdered Teresa and attempted to murder Jennifer. Now, by this point, the details of what happened had spread amongst the city, and everyone was aware of the horrific atrocities Isaiah had committed, as well as his many brushes with both law enforcement and mental health professionals. And of course, there was a rage because everyone was like, why the hell? It's not like this was once or twice. It was like 10 different separate occasions where he could have been placed in a mental health facility or arrested or put on medication or anything. And everyone just kind of washed their hands of him because they didn't want to deal with it. Now, at his pretrial hearings, it was decided that due to his history of severe mental illness, prosecutors would not be seeking the death penalty. However, although they deemed him mentally ill enough to avoid death, they still deemed him competent enough to stand trial and potentially receive life in prison. So even while in prison awaiting trial, and even during his trial, Isaiah showed extreme erratic behavior, including starving himself for 12 days at a time, rambling about how his food and water is being poisoned by the guards, and how the government is planning to infect every African American with HIV. He was held at Western State Hospital for more mental evaluations, and although they maintained that he did have bipolar disorder and traits of a sociopath, they declared that he had no major mental illnesses to explain his extreme behavior and actions. He continued to lash out in court, screaming that his counsel was wasting his time and not representing him properly, and at one point even attempted to demand to be able to represent himself, and at one point spat in his lawyer's face, which resulted in him being strapped to a chair with a mouth guard on for the remainder of the trial. So his trial would begin on July 1st, 2011, and Jennifer was the first to take the stand to describe step-by-step the events of that night 2 years ago. Jennifer explained that she eventually found out later on that Isaiah more than likely got into the house by climbing through the bathroom window, which had been left cracked due to the hot temperatures. Like I said at the beginning of the episode, that was really common, it's still common, and so he managed to get in somehow, probably through the window. And as she explained in detail the sexual torture that Isaiah had inflicted upon her and Teresa, the judge actually had to call a recess midway through her testimony to allow the jurors to leave and compose themselves as all of them burst into tears. So you want to talk about, like, that's how horrific it was. So investigators were never actually able to determine just exactly how or why Isaiah came across Teresa and Jennifer. Like, they didn't know if he was just maybe wandering the street and noticed an open window of a house. Maybe he spotted them on a previous occasion, because Isaiah would never confirm how or why he chose the house. And so that part is still really a mystery. And honestly, it just seems completely random. It was just a random attack, a random act of violence. Isaiah himself actually took the stand. And when he was questioned by prosecutors, he stated, "I was there that night. And I was told by my God and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to attack my enemies. I followed the instructions of God." After 4 weeks of testimony from mental health officials and members of Isaiah's own family, the jury departed to deliberate, and on July 1st, they returned with a verdict. They found him guilty on all charges of first-degree murder of Teresa Butts, first-degree rape of Teresa and Jennifer, first-degree attempted murder, and first-degree burglary. At his sentencing, Teresa's parents and siblings all addressed the court and Isaiah and spoke of Teresa's bravery and kindness and their hope for a maximum sentence for Isaiah. However, they also addressed him directly and stated that they pray for his soul daily and that they hope one day he is truly sorry for what he did and can go to heaven. Isaiah actually thanked them for saying that and started to cry.
He's also a sociopath.
But also that just shows you Teresa's family, like, the horrible things that he did to their daughter. At the same time, they were still like, hopefully one day you, in your heart, are truly sorry and you can go to heaven. Because it's like, we don't want you to go to hell. We're that good of people. After that, next to speak was Jennifer, who thanked the court for being honest and respectful during the trial. She then addressed Isaiah directly and told him, "I realize that there is nothing I can say to you because I did beg you for my life and Teresa begged you for hers. And I tried to show you our humanity and any shred of goodness I was hoping you could see. And it didn't matter that day, so I can't understand how it would matter today. But I do want to say to you that I wish you peace and that I do not hate you and I am so sorry for whatever happened in your life that brought you to this. You took so much from me, but I promise you, I am not broken. I do not wish you harm. I do not want revenge. I don't want anything bad to happen to you in prison. I wish you peace every last day of your life. So again, this shows you what kind of person Jennifer was. She's like, I don't want ill will towards you. I'm not hoping you are miserable or tortured. And she's actually like, I'm sorry for you for like everything you went through. And this just shows you how strong she was to like look her attacker in the eye and be able to say, I forgive you and I hope the rest of your life is peaceful. Now, as Jennifer closed out her statement, Isaiah began to once again act incoherent and began to ramble about how gay marriage should never be legal and that it was against God. The judge overseeing the case officially sentenced Isaiah to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So, over the years since her attack, Jennifer continues to speak out against sexual violence towards women across the country and speaks openly about Teresa and how it was her bravery that saved her that night. She is also very open and honest about her forgiveness of Isaiah, stating that she truly has forgiven him and she holds no ill will towards him and that it's for her own peace, not his. She continues to hold memorial concerts and songs for Teresa, and during one memorial for Teresa at the venue that was meant to host her wedding to Jennifer, Jennifer stood in front of the crowd of mourners and addressed Teresa directly, telling her, I promise to live and I promise to love. I promise to laugh, I promise to sing, I promise to dream, and I promise to forgive. Teresa Butts, you were the best thing that ever happened to me. And you once told me that you were lovable, but also you were leavable. And so I want you to look around this room right now, because we will never leave you, none of us. And that is the sad story of Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper.
That really is a sad story, and it's also one that you can't help but put yourself in their place while that's going down and thinking about, you know, what would I do if that had happened to me and the person that I loved? That's a really, that was a really heartbreaking case right there.
It was very heartbreaking. It's very tragic. It's very infuriating too, because I think that really shows how mental health is still not taken as seriously as it should be here in America. Like, it's still, we've made strides, of course, but it's still that, like, subject that you're not supposed to talk about, you know? You're supposed to deal with it yourself. You're not supposed to get therapy or help, especially with men.
Well, also, that just shows, like, where mental health falls through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, to this day, there are so many cases, and I'm sure there's so many that we'll never know that is directly affected by someone who has a mental illness being just let free to roam without being medicated or any kind of like involvement in that person to make sure that their health and well-being is going to be taken care of.
Exactly. And so it's like Isaiah was obviously a deeply disturbed man. He was a monster, but he was a deeply disturbed man that the system failed time and time again his whole life.
The system failed everybody because his actions ruined, you know, like someone else's life. That's kind of on everybody that was involved. Everybody that shuffled the paper and sent him along has a little bit of responsibility in what he done later.
Exactly. And again, like, this is a heartbreaking case, but at the same time, I wanted to talk about this case, especially because of Teresa's actions in her final moments. Like, she found the strength after being stabbed multiple times in the neck to fight off her attacker, smash him in the head with a metal bar, and then crash through a window just to be like, I'm gonna use my final moments, if I can't save myself, to at least save the woman I love and I'm gonna marry. And so I think this is really just a good testament to the power of love, and especially to queer love, because, you know, there's still a lot of people out there that are like, oh, it's not really, you know, it's not a real marriage or relationship because it's two women or two dudes. But I think this really shows you, like, no, this is real, true love right here. Using your final breath to try and save them. If not, if you can't save yourself, just save them. And so it's really heartbreaking, but at the same time, it's really moving the fact that, and also it's really moving that fact that she risked her life to do that. But at the same time, Jennifer was able to forgive her attacker for all these atrocities that he committed against them, and that she was able to look him in the eye in a courtroom and tell him not just that she forgives him, but that she wishes him peace for the rest of his life. Honestly, I don't think I would have it in me to do that.
She's a better person than I am.
Yeah, so she was such a strong person. And so I hope her life is happy and she's at peace too right now. And with that, thank you guys so much for tuning in for another episode. We hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, please leave us a review or a rating on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out, helps other people discover the podcast, and we just love hearing your guys' thoughts. If you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you soon.
Bye.